This is not another admonishment of no pain, no gain. This is the most simple and basic component of life. Our struggles determine our successes. Our problems birth our happiness along with slightly better, slightly upgraded problems. See? It's a never-ending upward spiral. And if you think at any point you're allowed to stop climbing, I'm afraid you're missing the point. Because the joy is in the climb itself. Chapter 3. You are not special. I once knew a guy. We'll call him Jimmy. Jimmy always had various business ventures going. On any given day, if you asked him what he was doing, he'd rattle off the name of some firm he was consulting with. Or he'd describe a promising medical app he was looking for angel investors to fund. Or he'd talk about some charity event he was supposed to be the keynote speaker for. Or how he had an idea for a more efficient type of gas pump that was going to make him billions. The guy was always rolling, always on, and if you gave him an inch of conversational daylight, he'd pulverize you about how world-spinning his work was, how brilliant his latest ideas were, and he'd name-drop so much it felt like you were talking to a tabloid reporter. Jimmy was all positivity all the time, always pushing himself, always working an angle, a real go-getter, whatever the fuck that means. The catch was that Jimmy was also a total deadbeat. All talk and no walk. Stoned a majority of the time and spending as much money in bars and fine restaurants as he did on his business ideas, Jimmy was a professional leech, living off his family's hard-won money by spending them as well as everybody else in the city on false ideas of future tech glory. Sure, sometimes he'd put in some token effort, or pick up the phone and cold call some bigwig and name drop until he ran out of names, but nothing ever actually happened. None of these ventures ever blossomed into anything. Yet the guy kept this up for years, living off girlfriends and more distant relatives well into his late 20s. And the most screwed up part was that Jimmy felt good about it. He had a delusional level of self-confidence. People who laughed at him or hung up on him were, in his mind, missing the opportunity of their lives. People who called him out on his bogus business ideas were too ignorant and inexperienced to understand his genius. People who pointed out his deadbeat lifestyle were jealous. They were haters who envied his success. Jimmy did make some money, although it was usually through the sketchiest of means, like selling another person's business idea as his own, or finagling a loan from someone, or worse, talking someone into giving him equity in their startup. He actually occasionally talked people into paying him to do some public speaking. About what, I can't even imagine. The worst part was that Jimmy believed his own bullshit. His delusion was so bulletproof it was honestly hard to get mad at him. It was actually kind of amazing. Sometime in the 1960s, developing high self-esteem, having positive thoughts and feelings about oneself, became all the rage in psychology. Research found that people who thought highly about themselves generally performed better and caused fewer problems. Many researchers and policymakers at the time came to believe that raising a population's self-esteem could lead to some tangible social benefits. Lower crime, better academic records, greater employment, lower budget deficits. As a result, beginning in the next decade, the 1970s, self-esteem practices began to be taught to parents, emphasized by therapists, politicians, and teachers, and instituted into educational policy. Grade inflations, for example, was implemented to make low-achieving kids feel better about their lack of achievement. Participation awards and bogus trophies were invented for any number of mundane and expected activities. Kids were given inane homework assignments, like writing down all the reasons why they thought they were special, or the five things they liked most about themselves. Pastors and ministers told their congregations that they were each uniquely special in God's eyes and were destined to excel and not be average. Business and motivational seminars cropped up chanting the same paradoxical mantra, "Every single one of us can be exceptional and massively successful." But it's a generation later, and the data is in. We're not all exceptional. It turns out that merely feeling good about yourself doesn't really mean anything unless you have a good reason to feel good about yourself. It turns out that adversity and failure are actually useful and even necessary for developing strong-minded and successful adults. It turns out that teaching people to believe they're exceptional and to feel good about themselves no matter what doesn't lead to a population full of Bill Gateses and Martin Luther Kings. It leads to a population full of Jimmys. Jimmy, the delusional startup founder. Jimmy, who smoked pot every day and had no real marketable skills other than talking himself up and believing it. Jimmy, the type of guy who yelled at his business partner for being immature, and then maxed out the company credit card at Le Bernardin trying to impress some Russian model. Jimmy, who was quickly running out of aunts and uncles who could loan him more money. Yes, that confident, high self-esteem Jimmy. The Jimmy who spent so much time talking about how good he was that he forgot to, you know, actually do something. The problem with the self-esteem movement is that it measured self-esteem by how positively people felt about themselves. But a true and accurate measurement of one's self-worth is how people feel about the negative aspects of themselves. If a person like Jimmy feels absolutely fucking great 99.9% of the time, despite his life falling apart around him, then how can that be a valid metric for a successful and happy life? Jimmy is entitled. That is, he feels as though he deserves good things without actually earning them. He believes he should be able to be rich without actually working for it. He believes he should be liked and well-connected without actually helping anyone. He believes he should have an amazing lifestyle without actually sacrificing anything. People like Jimmy become so fixated on feeling good about themselves that they manage to delude themselves into believing that they are accomplishing great things even when they're not. They believe they're the brilliant presenter on stage when actually they're making a fool of themselves. They believe they're the successful startup founder when, in fact, they've never had a successful venture. They call themselves life coaches and charge money to help others, even though they're only 25 years old and haven't actually accomplished anything substantial in their lives. Entitled people exude a delusional degree of self-confidence. This confidence can be alluring to others, at least for a little while. In some instances, the entitled person's delusional level of confidence can become contagious and help the people around the entitled person feel more confident in themselves, too. Despite all of Jimmy's shenanigans, I have to admit that it was fun hanging out with him sometimes. He felt indestructible around him. But the problem with entitlement is that it makes people need to feel good about themselves all the time, even at the expense of those around them. And because entitled people always need to feel good about themselves, they end up spending most of their time thinking about themselves. After all, it takes a lot of energy and work to convince yourself that your shit doesn't stink, especially when you've actually been living in a toilet. Once people have developed the thought pattern to constantly construe what happens around them as self-aggrandizing, it's extremely hard to break them out of it. Any attempt to reason with them is seen as simply another threat to their superiority by another person who can't handle how smart or talented or good-looking or successful they are. Entitlement closes in upon itself in a kind of narcissistic bubble, distorting anything and everything in such a way as to reinforce itself. People who feel entitled view every occurrence in their life as either an affirmation of or a threat to their own greatness. If something good happens to them, it's because of some amazing feat they accomplished. If something bad happens to them, it's because somebody is jealous and trying to bring them down a notch. Entitlement is impervious. People who are entitled delude themselves into whatever feeds their sense of superiority. They keep their mental facade standing at all costs, even if it sometimes requires being physically or emotionally abusive to those around them. But entitlement is a failed strategy. It's just another high. It's not happiness. The true measurement of self-worth is not how a person feels about her positive experiences, but rather how she feels about her negative experiences. A person like Jimmy hides from his problems by making up imagined successes for himself at every turn. And because he can't face his problems, no matter how good he feels about himself, he is weak. A person who actually has a high self-worth is able to look at the negative parts of his character frankly. Yes, sometimes I'm irresponsible with money. Yes, sometimes I exaggerate my own success. Yes, I rely too much on others to support me and should be more self-reliant. And then acts to improve upon them. But entitled people, because they are incapable of acknowledging their own problems openly and honestly, are incapable of improving their lives in any lasting or meaningful way. They are left chasing high after high and accumulate greater and greater levels of denial. But eventually, reality must hit, and the underlying problems will once again make themselves clear. It's just a question of when and how painful it will be. Things fall apart. I sat in my 9 a.m. biology class, arms cradling my head on my desk, as I stared at the clock's second hand making laps, each tick syncopated with the teacher's dronings on about chromosomes and mitosis. Like most 13-year-olds stuck in a stuffy, fluorescent classroom, I was bored. A knock came on the door. Mr. Price, the school's assistant principal, stuck his head in.
"Excuse me for interrupting. Mark, can you step outside with me for a moment? Oh, and bring your things with you."
Strange, I thought. Kids get sent to the principal, but the principal rarely gets sent to them. I gathered my things and stepped out. The hallway was empty. Hundreds of beige lockers converged on the horizon.
"Mark, can you take me to your locker, please?"
"Sure," I say, and slug myself down the hall, baggy jeans and moppy hair and oversized Pantera t-shirt and all. We get to my locker.
"Open it, please," Mr. Price says.
So I do. He steps in front of me and gathers my coat, my gym bag, my backpack, all of the locker's contents, minus a few notebooks and pencils. He starts walking away.
"Come with me, please," he says, without looking back.
I start to get an uneasy feeling. I follow him to his office, where he asks me to sit down. He closes the door and locks it. He goes over to the window and adjusts the blinds to block the view from outside. My palms begin to sweat. This is not a normal principal visit. Mr. Price sits down and quietly rummages through my things, checking pockets, unzipping zippers, shaking out my gym clothes and placing them on the floor. Without looking up at me, Mr. Price asks,
"Do you know what I'm looking for, Mark?"
"No," I say.
"Drugs."
The word shocks me into nervous attention.
"Drugs?"
I stammer.
"What kind?"
He looks at me sternly.
"I don't know. What kind do you have?"
He opens one of my binders and checks the small pockets meant for pens. My sweat blossoms like a fungal growth. It spreads from my palms to my arms and now my neck. My temples pulsate as blood floods my brain and face. Like most 13-year-olds freshly accused of possessing narcotics and bringing them to school, I want to run away and hide.
"I don't know what you're talking about,"
I protest, the words sounding far meeker than I'd like. I feel as if I should be sounding confident in myself right now. Or maybe not. Maybe I should be scared. Do liars sound more scared or more confident? Because however they sound, I want to sound the opposite. Instead, my lack of confidence compounds, unconfidence about my sounding unconfident making me more unconfident. That fucking feedback loop from hell.
"We'll see about that,"
he says, turning his attention to my backpack, which seemingly has 100 pockets. Each is loaded with its own silly teen desiderata, colored pens, old notes passed in class, early 90s CDs with cracked cases, dried-up markers, an old sketch pad with half its pages missing, dust and lint and crap accumulated during a maddeningly circuitous middle school existence. My sweat must be pumping at the speed of light, because time extends itself and dilates such that what is mere seconds on that 9 a.m. second period biology clock now feels like Paleolithic eons, and I'm growing up and dying every minute. Just me and Mr. Price and my bottomless backpack. Somewhere around the Mesolithic age, Mr. Price finishes searching the backpack. Having found nothing, he seems flustered. He turns the pack upside down and lets all of my crap crash onto his office floor. He's now sweating as profusely as I am, except in place of my terror, there is his anger.
"No drugs today, huh?"
he tries to sound casual.
"Nope,
so do I." He spreads my stuff out, separating each item and coagulating them into little piles beside my gym gear. My coat and backpack now lie empty and lifeless on his lap. He sighs and stares at the wall. Like most 13-year-olds locked in an office with a man angrily throwing their shit all over the floor, I want to cry. Mr. Price scans the contents organized on the floor. Nothing illicit or illegal, no narcotics, not even anything against school policy. He sighs and then throws the coat and backpack on the floor, too. He bends over and puts his elbows on his knees, making his face level with mine. Mark, I'm going to give you one last chance to be honest with me. If you are honest, this will turn out much better for you. If it turns out you're lying, then it's going to be much worse. As if on cue, I gulp. Now tell me the truth, Mr. Price demands. Did you bring drugs to school today? Fighting back tears, screams clawing at my throat, I stare my tormentor in the face and, in a pleading voice, dying to be relieved of its adolescent horrors, I say, No, I don't have any drugs. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, he says, signaling surrender. I guess you can collect your things and go. He takes one last longing gaze at my deflated backpack, lying like a broken promise there on his office floor. He casually puts one foot down on the pack, stomping lightly, a last-ditch effort. I anxiously wait for him to get up and leave so I can get on with my life and forget this whole nightmare. But his foot stops on something. What is this? He asks, tapping with his foot.
What is what?
I say. There's still something in here. He picks up the bag and starts feeling around the bottom of it. For me, the room gets fuzzy. Everything goes wobbly. When I was young, I was smart. I was friendly. But I was also a shithead. I mean that in the most loving way possible. I was a rebellious, lying little shithead, angry and full of resentment. When I was 12, I hacked my house's security system with refrigerator magnets so I could sneak out undetected in the middle of the night. My friend and I would put his mom's car in neutral and push it into the street so we could drive around without waking her up. I would write papers about abortion because I knew my English teacher was a hardcore conservative Christian. Another friend and I stole cigarettes from his mom and sold them to kids out behind the school. And I also cut a secret compartment into the bottom of my backpack to hide my marijuana. That was the same hidden compartment Mr. Price found after stepping on the drugs I was hiding. I had been lying, and as promised, Mr. Price didn't go easy on me. A few hours later, like most 13-year-olds handcuffed in the back of a police car, I thought my life was over. And I was kind of right in a way. My parents quarantined me at home. I was to have no friends for the foreseeable future. Having been expelled from school, I was to be homeschooled for the rest of the year. My mom made me get a haircut and threw out all of my Marilyn Manson and Metallica shirts, which for an adolescent in 1998 was tantamount to being sentenced to death by lameness. My dad dragged me to his office with him in the mornings and made me file papers for hours on end. Once homeschooling was over, I was enrolled in a small private Christian school where, and this may not surprise you, I didn't exactly fit in. And just when I had finally cleaned up my act and turned in my assignments and learned the value of good clerical responsibility, my parents decided to get divorced. I tell you all of this only to point out that my adolescence sucked donkey balls. I lost all of my friends, my community, my legal rights, and my family within the span of about 9 months. My therapist in my 20s would later call this some real traumatic shit, and I would spend the next decade and change working on unraveling it and becoming less of a self-absorbed, entitled little prick. The problem with my home life back then was not all of the horrible things that were said or done. Rather, it was all of the horrible things that needed to be said and done but weren't. My family stonewalls the way Warren Buffett makes money or Jenna Jameson fucks. We're champions at it. The house could have been burning down around us, and it would have been met with,
Oh, no, everything's fine. A tad warm in here, perhaps, but really, everything's fine.
When my parents got divorced, there were no broken dishes, no slammed doors, no screaming arguments about who fucked whom. Once they had reassured my brother and me that it wasn't our fault, we had a Q&A session. Yes, you read that right, about the logistics of the new living arrangements. Not a tear was shed. Not a voice was raised. The closest peek my brother and I got into our parents' unraveling emotional lives was hearing, "Nobody cheated on anybody." Oh, that's nice. It was a tad warm in the room, but really, everything was fine. My parents are good people. I don't blame them for any of this, not anymore at least. And I love them very much. They have their own stories and their own journeys and their own problems, just as all parents do, and just as all of their parents do, and so on. And like all parents, my parents, with the best of intentions, imparted some of their problems to me, as I probably will to my kids. When real traumatic shit like this happens in our lives, we begin to unconsciously feel as though we have problems that we're incapable of ever solving. And this assumed inability to solve our problems causes us to feel miserable and helpless. But it also causes something else to happen. If we have problems that are unsolvable, our unconscious figures that we're either uniquely special or uniquely defective in some way. That we're somehow unlike everyone else and that the rules must be different for us. Put simply, we become entitled. The pain from my adolescence led me down a road of entitlement that lasted through much of my early adulthood. Whereas Jimmy's entitlement played out in the business world, where he pretended to be a huge success, my entitlement played out in my relationships, particularly with women. My trauma had revolved around intimacy and acceptance, so I felt a constant need to overcompensate, to prove to myself that I was loved and accepted at all times. And as a result, I soon took to chasing women the same way a cocaine addict takes to a snowman made out of cocaine. I made sweet love to it, and then promptly suffocated myself in it. I became a player, an immature, selfish, albeit sometimes charming player. And I strung up a long series of superficial and unhealthy relationships for the better part of a decade. It wasn't so much the sex I craved, although the sex was fun. It was the validation. I was wanted. I was loved. For the first time since I could remember, I was worthy. My craving for validation quickly fed into a mental habit of self-aggrandizing and overindulgence. I felt entitled to say or do whatever I wanted, to break people's trust, to ignore people's feelings and then justify it later with shitty, half-assed apologies. While this period certainly had its moments of fun and excitement, and I met some wonderful women, my life was more or less a wreck the whole time. I was often unemployed, living on friends' couches or with my mom, drinking way more than I should have been, alienating a number of friends. And when I did meet a woman I really liked, my self-absorption quickly torpedoed everything. The deeper the pain, the more helpless we feel against our problems, and the more entitlement we adopt to compensate for those problems. This entitlement plays out in one of two ways. One, I'm awesome and the rest of you all suck, so I deserve special treatment. Two, I suck and the rest of you are all awesome, so I deserve special treatment. Opposite mindset on the outside, but the same selfish, creamy core in the middle. In fact, you will often see self-entitled people flip back and forth between the two. Either they're on top of the world or the world is on top of them, depending on the day of the week, or how well they're doing in their particular addiction at that moment. Most people correctly identify a person like Jimmy as a raging narcissistic asshat. That's because he's pretty blatant in his delusionally high self-regard. What most people don't correctly identify as entitlement are those people who perpetually feel as though they're inferior and unworthy of the world. Because construing everything in life so as to make yourself out to be constantly victimized requires just as much selfishness as the opposite. It takes just as much energy and delusional self-aggrandizement to maintain the belief that one has insurmountable problems as that one has no problems at all. The truth is that there's no such thing as a personal problem. If you've got a problem, chances are millions of other people have had it in the past, have it now, and are going to have it in the future. Likely people you know, too. That doesn't minimize the problem or mean that it shouldn't hurt. It doesn't mean you aren't legitimately a victim in some circumstances. It just means that you're not special. Often, it's this realization that you and your problems are actually not privileged in their severity or pain that is the first and most important step toward solving them. But for some reason, it appears that more and more people, particularly young people, are forgetting this. Numerous professors and educators have noted a lack of emotional resilience and an excess of selfish demands in today's young people. It's not uncommon now for books to be removed from a class's curriculum for no other reason than that they made someone feel bad. Speakers and professors are shouted down and banned from campuses for infractions as simple as suggesting that maybe some Halloween costumes really aren't that offensive. School counselors note that more students than ever are exhibiting severe signs of emotional distress over what are otherwise run-of-the-mill daily college experiences, such as an argument with a roommate or getting a low grade in a class. It's strange that in an age when we are more connected than ever, entitlements seem to be at an all-time high. Something about recent technology seems to allow our insecurities to run amok like never before. The more freedom we're given to express ourselves, the more we want to be free of having to deal with anyone who may disagree with us or upset us. The more exposed we are to opposing viewpoints, the more we seem to get upset that those other viewpoints exist. The easier and more problem-free our lives become, the more we seem to feel entitled for them to get even better. The benefits of the Internet and social media are unquestionably fantastic. In many ways, this is the best time in history to be alive. But perhaps these technologies are having some unintended social side effects. Perhaps these same technologies that have liberated and educated so many are simultaneously enabling people's sense of entitlement more than ever before. The tyranny of exceptionalism. Most of us are pretty average at most things we do. Even if you're exceptional at one thing, chances are you're average or below average at most other things. That's just the nature of life. To become truly great at something, you have to dedicate shit tons of time and energy to do it. And because we all have limited time and energy, few of us ever become truly exceptional at more than one thing, if anything at all. We can then say that it's a statistical improbability that any single person will be an extraordinary performer in all areas of life, or even in many areas of their life. Brilliant business people are often fuck-ups in their personal lives. Extraordinary athletes are often shallow and as dumb as a lobotomized rock. Many celebrities are probably just as clueless about life as the people who gawk at them and follow their every move. We're all, for the most part, pretty average people. But it's the extremes that get all of the publicity. We kind of know this already, but we rarely think and or talk about it. And we certainly never discuss why this could be a problem. Having the Internet, Google, Facebook, YouTube, and access to 500-plus channels of television is amazing, but our attention is limited. There's no way we can process the tidal waves of information flowing past us constantly. Therefore, the only zeros and ones that break through and catch our attention are the truly exceptional pieces of information, those in the 99.999th percentile. All day, every day, we are flooded with the truly extraordinary, the best of the best, the worst of the worst, the greatest physical feats, the funniest jokes, the most upsetting news, the scariest threats, non-stop. Our lives today are filled with information from the extremes of the bell curve of human experience, because in the media business, that's what gets eyeballs, and eyeballs bring dollars. That's the bottom line. Yet the vast majority of life resides in the humdrum middle. The vast majority of life is unextraordinary. Indeed, quite average. This flood of extreme information has conditioned us to believe that exceptionalism is the new normal. And because we're all quite average most of the time, the deluge of exceptional information drives us to feel pretty damn insecure and desperate. Because clearly we are somehow not good enough. So, more and more, we feel the need to compensate through entitlement and addiction. We cope the only way we know how, either through self-aggrandizing or through other aggrandizing. Some of us do this by cooking up get-rich-quick schemes. Others do it by taking off across the world to save starving babies in Africa. Others do it by excelling in school and winning every award. Others do it by shooting up a school. Others do it by trying to have sex with anything that talks and breathes. This ties into the growing culture of entitlement that I talked about earlier. Millennials often get blamed for this cultural shift, but that's likely because millennials are the most plugged in and visible generation. In fact, the tendency toward entitlement is apparent across all of society, and I believe it's linked to mass media-driven exceptionalism. The problem is that the pervasiveness of technology and mass marketing is screwing up a lot of people's expectations for themselves. The inundation of the exceptional makes people feel worse about themselves, makes them feel that they need to be more extreme, more radical, and more self-assured to get noticed or even matter. When I was a young man, my insecurities around intimacy were exacerbated by all the ridiculous narratives of masculinity circulating through pop culture. And those same narratives are still circulating. To be a cool guy, you have to party like a rock star. To be respected, you have to be admired by women. Sex is the most valuable thing a man can attain, and it's worth sacrificing anything, including your own dignity, to get it. This constant stream of unrealistic media dogpiles onto our existing feelings of insecurity by overexposing us to the unrealistic standards we fail to live up to. Not only do we feel subjected to unsolvable problems, but we feel like losers because a simple Google search shows us thousands of people without those same problems. Technology has solved old economic problems by giving us new psychological problems. The Internet has not just open-sourced information. It has also open-sourced insecurity, self-doubt, and shame.
But if I'm not going to be special or extraordinary, what's the point?
It has become an accepted part of our culture today to believe that we are all destined to do something truly extraordinary. Celebrities say it. Business tycoons say it. Politicians say it. Even Oprah says it, so it must be true. Each and every one of us can be extraordinary. We all deserve greatness. The fact that this statement is inherently contradictory, after all, if everyone were extraordinary, then by definition no one would be extraordinary, is missed by most people. And instead of questioning what we actually deserve or don't deserve, we eat the message up and ask for more. Being average has become the new standard of failure. The worst thing you can be is in the middle of the pack, the middle of the bell curve. When a culture's standard of success is to be extraordinary, it then becomes better to be at the extreme low end of the bell curve than to be in the middle, because at least there you're still special and deserve attention. Many people choose this strategy, to prove to everyone that they are the most miserable or the most depressed or the most victimized. A lot of people are afraid to accept mediocrity because they believe that if they accept it, they'll never achieve anything, never improve, and that their life won't matter. This sort of thinking is dangerous. Once you accept the premise that a life is worthwhile only if it is truly notable and great, then you basically accept the fact that most of the human population, including yourself, sucks and is worthless. And this mindset can quickly turn dangerous to both yourself and others. The rare people who do become truly exceptional at something do so not because they believe they're exceptional. On the contrary, they become amazing because they're obsessed with improvement. And that obsession with improvement stems from an unerring belief that they are, in fact, not that great at all. It's anti-entitlement. People who become great at something become great because they understand that they're not already great. They are mediocre, they are average, and that they could be so much better. All of this every person can be extraordinary and achieve greatness stuff is basically just jerking off your ego. It's a message that tastes good going down, but in reality is nothing more than empty calories that makes you emotionally fat and bloated, the proverbial Big Mac for your heart and your brain. The ticket to emotional health, like that to physical health, comes from eating your veggies, that is, accepting the bland and mundane truths of life. Truths such as, your actions actually don't matter that much in the grand scheme of things, and the vast majority of your life will be boring and not noteworthy, and that's okay. This vegetable course will taste bad at first, very bad. You will avoid accepting it. But once ingested, your body will wake up feeling more potent and more alive. After all, that constant pressure to be something amazing, to be the next big thing, will be lifted off your back. The stress and anxiety of always feeling inadequate and constantly needing to prove yourself will dissipate. and the knowledge and acceptance of your own mundane existence will actually free you to accomplish what you truly wish to accomplish, without judgment or lofty expectations. You will have a growing appreciation for life's basic experiences. The pleasures of simple friendship, creating something, helping a person in need, reading a good book, laughing with someone you care about. Sounds boring, doesn't it? That's because these things are ordinary. But maybe they're ordinary for a reason. Because they are what actually matters. Chapter 4. The Value of Suffering. In the closing months of 1944, after almost a decade of war, the tide was turning against Japan. Their economy was floundering, their military overstretched across half of Asia, and the territories they had won throughout the Pacific were now toppling like dominoes to U.S. forces. Defeat seemed inevitable. On December 26, 1944, Second Lieutenant Hiro Onoda of the Japanese Imperial Army was deployed to the small island of Lubang in the Philippines. His orders were to slow the United States' progress as much as possible, to stand and fight at all costs, and to never surrender. Both he and his commander knew it was essentially a suicide mission. In February 1945, the Americans arrived on Lubang and took the island with overwhelming force. Within days, most of the Japanese soldiers had either surrendered or been killed, but Onoda and three of his men managed to hide in the jungle. From there, they began a guerrilla warfare campaign against the U.S. forces and the local population, attacking supply lines, shooting at stray soldiers, and interfering with the American forces in any way that they could. That August, half a year later, the United States dropped atomic bombs on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan surrendered, and the deadliest war in human history came to its dramatic conclusion. However, thousands of Japanese soldiers were still scattered among the Pacific Isles, and most, like Onoda, were hiding in the jungle, unaware that the war was over. These holdouts continued to fight and pillage as they had before. This was a real problem for rebuilding Eastern Asia after the war, and the governments agreed something must be done. The U.S. military, in conjunction with the Japanese government, dropped thousands of leaflets throughout the Pacific region, announcing that the war was over and it was time for everyone to go home. Onoda and his men, like many others, found and read these leaflets, but unlike most of the others, Onoda decided that they were fake, a trap set by the American forces to get the guerrilla fighters to show themselves. Onoda burned the leaflets, and he and his men stayed hidden and continued to fight. 5 years went by. The leaflets had stopped, and most of the American forces had long since gone home. The local population on Lubang attempted to return to their normal lives of farming and fishing. Yet there were Hiro Onoda and his merry men, still shooting at the farmers, burning their crops, stealing their livestock, and murdering locals who wandered too far into the jungle. The Philippine government then took drawing up new flyers and spreading them out across the jungle. "Come out," they said. "The war is over. You lost." But these, too, were ignored. In 1952, the Japanese government made one final effort to draw the last remaining soldiers out of hiding throughout the Pacific. This time, letters and pictures from the missing soldiers' families were airdropped, along with a personal note from the emperor himself. Once again, Onoda refused to believe that the information was real. Once again, he believed the airdrop to be a trick by the Americans. Once again, he and his men stood and continued to fight. Another few years went by, and the Philippine locals, sick of being terrorized, finally armed themselves and began firing back. By 1959, one of Onoda's companions had surrendered, and another had been killed. Then, a decade later, Onoda's last companion, a man called Kozuka, was killed in a shootout with the local police while he was burning rice fields, still waging war against the local population a full quarter century after the end of World War II. Onoda, having now spent more than half of his life in the jungles of Lubang, was all alone. In 1972, the news of Kozuka's death reached Japan and caused a stir. The Japanese people thought the last of the soldiers from the war had come home years earlier. The Japanese media began to wonder, if Kozuka had still been on Lubang until 1972, then perhaps Onoda himself, the last known Japanese holdout from World War II, might still be alive as well. That year, both the Japanese and Philippine governments sent search parties to look for the enigmatic second lieutenant, now part myth, part hero, and part ghost. They found nothing. As the months progressed, the story of Lieutenant Onoda morphed into something of an urban legend in Japan, the war hero who sounded too insane to actually exist. Many romanticized him. Others criticized him. Others thought he was the stuff of fairy tale, invented by those who still wanted to believe in a Japan that had disappeared long ago. It was around this time that a young man named Norio Suzuki first heard of Onoda. Suzuki was an adventurer, an explorer, and a bit of a hippie. Born after the war ended, he had dropped out of school and spent 4 years hitchhiking his way across Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, sleeping on park benches, in strangers' cars, in jail cells, and under the stars. He volunteered on farms for food and donated blood to pay for places to stay. He was a free spirit and perhaps a little bit nuts. In 1972, Suzuki needed another adventure. He had returned to Japan after his travels and found the strict cultural norms and social hierarchy to be stifling. He hated school. He couldn't hold down a job. He wanted to be back on the road, back on his own again. For Suzuki, the legend of Hiro Onoda came as the answer to his problems. It was a new and worthy adventure for him to pursue. Suzuki believed that he would be the one who would find Onoda. Sure, search parties conducted by the Japanese, Philippine, and American governments had not been able to find Onoda. Local police forces had been scavenging the jungle for almost 30 years with no luck. Thousands of leaflets had met with no response, but fuck it, this deadbeat college dropout hippie was going to be the one to find him. Unarmed and untrained for any sort of reconnaissance or tactical warfare, Suzuki traveled to Lebang and began wandering around the jungle all by himself. His strategy? Scream Onoda's name really loudly and tell him that the Emperor was worried about him. He found Onoda in 4 days. Suzuki stayed with Onoda in the jungle for some time. Onoda had been alone by that point for over a year, and once found by Suzuki, he welcomed the companionship and was desperate to learn what had been happening in the outside world from a Japanese source he could trust. The two men became sorta kind of friends. Suzuki asked Onoda why he had stayed and continued to fight. Onoda said it was simple. He had been given the order to never surrender, so he stayed. For nearly 30 years he had simply been following an order. Onoda then asked Suzuki why a hippie boy like himself came looking for him. Suzuki said that he'd left Japan in search of 3 things. Lieutenant Onoda, a panda bear, and the abominable snowman. In that order. The two men had been brought together under the most curious of circumstances. 2 well-intentioned adventurers chasing false visions of glory, like a real-life Japanese Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, stuck together in the damp recesses of a Philippine jungle, both imagining themselves heroes, despite both being alone with nothing, doing nothing. Onoda had already by then given up most of his life to a phantom war. Suzuki would give his up, too. Having already found Hiro Onoda and the panda bear, he would die a few years later in the Himalayas, still in search of the abominable snowman. Humans often choose to dedicate large portions of their lives to seemingly useless or destructive causes. On the surface, these causes make no sense. It's hard to imagine how Onoda could have been happy on that island for those 30 years. Living off insects and rodents, sleeping in the dirt, murdering civilians decade after decade. Or why Suzuki trekked off to his own death with no money, no companions, and no purpose other than to chase an imaginary yeti. Yet, later in his life, Onoda said he regretted nothing. He claimed that he was proud of his choices and his time on Lubang. He said that it had been an honor to devote a sizable portion of his life in service to a non-existent empire. Suzuki, had he survived, likely would have said something similar, that he was doing exactly what he was meant to do, that he regretted nothing. These men both chose how they wished to suffer. Hiro Onoda chose to suffer for loyalty to a dead empire. Suzuki chose to suffer for adventure, no matter how ill-advised. To both men, their suffering meant something. It fulfilled some greater cause. and because it meant something, they were able to endure it, or perhaps even enjoy it. If suffering is inevitable, if our problems in life are unavoidable, then the question we should be asking is not, how do I stop suffering? But, why am I suffering? For what purpose? Hiro Onoda returned to Japan in 1974 and became a kind of celebrity in his home country. He was shuttled around from talk show to radio station. Politicians clamored to shake his hand. He published a book and was even offered a large sum of money by the government. But what he found when he returned to Japan horrified him. A consumerist, capitalist, superficial culture that had lost all of the traditions of honor and sacrifice upon which his generation had been raised. Onoda tried to use his sudden celebrity to espouse the values of old Japan, but he was tone-deaf to this new society. He was seen more as a showpiece than as a serious cultural thinker, a Japanese man who had emerged from a time capsule for all to marvel at, like a relic in a museum. And in the irony of ironies, Onoda became far more depressed than he'd ever been in the jungle for all those years. At least in the jungle, his life had stood for something. It had meant something. That had made his suffering endurable, indeed, even a little bit desirable. But back in Japan, in what he considered to be a vacuous nation full of hippies and loose women in Western clothing, he was confronted with the unavoidable truth, that his fighting had meant nothing. The Japan he had lived and fought for no longer existed. And the weight of this realization pierced him in a way that no bullet ever had. Because his suffering had meant nothing, it suddenly became realized and true. 30 years wasted. And so, in 1980, Onoda packed up and moved to Brazil, where he remained until he died. The Self-Awareness Onion. Self-awareness is like an onion. There are multiple layers to it, and the more you peel them back, the more likely you're going to start crying at inappropriate times. Let's say the first layer of the self-awareness onion is a simple understanding of one's emotions.
This is when I feel happy.
This makes me feel sad.
This gives me hope.
Unfortunately, there are many people who suck at even this most basic level of self-awareness. I know because I'm one of them. My wife and I sometimes have a fun back and forth that goes something like this. Her.
What's wrong?
Me. Nothing's wrong. Nothing at all. Her.
No, something's wrong. Tell me.
Me. I'm fine, really. Her.
Are you sure? You look upset.
Me, with nervous laughter.
Really?
No, I'm okay. Seriously. 30 minutes later. Me.
And that's why I'm so fucking pissed off. He just acts as if I don't exist half the time.
We all have emotional blind spots. Often they have to do with emotions that we were taught were inappropriate growing up. It takes years of practice and effort to get good at identifying blind spots in ourselves and then expressing the affected emotions appropriately. But this task is hugely important and worth the effort. The second layer of the self-awareness onion is an ability to ask why we feel certain emotions. These why questions are difficult and often take months or even years to answer consistently and accurately. Most people need to go to some sort of therapist just to hear these questions asked for the first time. Such questions are important because they illuminate what we consider success or failure. Why do you feel angry? Is it because you failed to achieve some goal? Why do you feel lethargic and uninspired? Is it because you don't think you're good enough? This layer of questioning helps us understand the root cause of the emotions that overwhelm us. Once we understand that root cause, we can ideally do something to change it. But there's another, even deeper level of the self-awareness onion, and that one is full of fucking tears. The third level is our personal values. Why do I consider this to be success or failure? How am I choosing to measure myself? By what standard am I judging myself and everyone around me? This level, which takes constant questioning and effort, is incredibly difficult to reach. But it's the most important, because our values determine the nature of our problems. And the nature of our problems determines the quality of our lives.
Values underlie everything we are and do. If what we value is unhelpful, if what we consider success or failure is poorly chosen, then everything based upon those values, the thoughts, the emotions, the day-to-day feelings, will all be out of whack. Everything we think and feel about a situation ultimately comes back to how valuable we perceive it to be. Most people are horrible at answering these why questions accurately, and this prevents them from achieving a deeper knowledge of their own values. Sure, they may say they value honesty and a true friend, but then they turn around and lie about you behind your back to make themselves feel better. People may perceive that they feel lonely, but when they ask themselves why they feel lonely, they tend to come up with a way to blame others. Everyone else is mean, or no one is cool or smart enough to understand them, and thus they further avoid their problem instead of seeking to solve it. For many people, this passes as self-awareness, and yet, if they were able to go deeper and look at their underlying values, they would see that their original analysis was based on avoiding responsibility for their own problem, rather than accurately identifying the problem. They would see that their decisions were based on chasing highs, not generating true happiness. Most self-help gurus ignore this deeper level of self-awareness as well. They take people who are miserable because they want to be rich, and then give them all sorts of advice on how to make more money, all the while ignoring important values-based questions. Why do they feel such a need to be rich in the first place? How are they choosing to measure success or failure for themselves? Is it not perhaps some particular value that's the root cause of their unhappiness, and not the fact that they don't drive a Bentley yet? Much of the advice out there operates at a shallow level of simply trying to make people feel good in the short term, while the real long-term problems never get solved. People's perceptions and feelings may change, but the underlying values and the metrics by which those values are assessed stay the same. This is not real progress. This is just another way to achieve more highs. Honest self-questioning is difficult. It requires asking yourself simple questions that are uncomfortable to answer. In fact, in my experience, the more uncomfortable the answer, the more likely it is to be true. Take a moment and think of something that's really bugging you. Now ask yourself why it bugs you. Chances are the answers will involve a failure of some sort. Then take that failure and ask why it seems true to you. What if that failure wasn't really a failure? What if you've been looking at it the wrong way? A recent example from my own life. It bugs me that my brother doesn't return my texts or emails. Why? Because it feels like he doesn't give a shit about me. Why does this seem true? Because if he wanted to have a relationship with me, he would take 10 seconds out of his day to interact with me. Why does his lack of a relationship with you feel like a failure? Because we're brothers. We're supposed to have a good relationship. Two things are operating here. A value that I hold dear, and a metric that I use to assess progress toward that value. My value. Brothers are supposed to have a good relationship with one another. My metric. Being in contact by phone or email. This is how I measure my success as a brother. By holding on to this metric, I make myself feel like a failure, which occasionally ruins my Saturday mornings. We could dig even deeper by repeating the process. Why are brothers supposed to have a good relationship? Because they're family, and family are supposed to be close. Why does that seem true? Because your family is supposed to matter to you more than anyone else. Why does that seem true? Because being close with your family is normal and healthy, and I don't have that. In this exchange, I'm clear about my underlying value, having a good relationship with my brother, but I'm still struggling with my metric. I've given it another name, closeness, but the metric hasn't really changed. I'm still judging myself as a brother based on frequency of contact, and comparing myself, using that metric, against other people I know. Everyone else, or so it seems, has a close relationship with their family members, and I don't. So, obviously, there must be something wrong with me. But what if I'm choosing a poor metric for myself and my life? What else could be true that I'm not considering? Well, perhaps I don't need to be close to my brother to have that good relationship that I value. Perhaps there just needs to be some mutual respect, which there is. Or maybe mutual trust is what to look for, and it's there. Perhaps these metrics would be better assessments of brotherhood than how many text messages he and I exchange.
This clearly makes sense. It feels true for me. But it still fucking hurts that my brother and I aren't close. And there is no positive way to spin it. There's no secret way to glorify myself through this knowledge. Sometimes brothers, even brothers who love each other, don't have close relationships, and that's fine. It is hard to accept at first, but that's fine. What is objectively true about your situation is not as important as how you come to see the situation, how you choose to measure it and value it. Problems may be inevitable, but the meaning of each problem is not. We get to control what our problems mean based on how we choose to think about them, the standard by which we choose to measure them. Rockstar problems. In 1983, a talented young guitarist was kicked out of his band in the worst possible way. The band had just been signed to a record deal, and they were about to record their first album. But a couple days before recording began, the band showed the guitarist the door. No warning, no discussion, no dramatic blowout. They literally woke him up one day by handing him a bus ticket home. As he sat on the bus back to Los Angeles from New York, the guitarist kept asking himself, "How did this happen? What did I do wrong? What will I do now?" Record contracts didn't exactly fall out of the sky, especially for raucous, upstart metal bands. Had he missed his one and only shot? But by the time the bus hit L.A., the guitarist had gotten over his self-pity and had vowed to start a new band. He decided that this new band would be so successful that his old band would forever regret their decision. He would become so famous that they would be subjected to decades of seeing him on TV, hearing him on the radio, seeing posters of him in the streets and pictures of him in magazines. They'd be flipping burgers somewhere, loading vans from their shitty club gigs, fat and drunk with their ugly wives, and he'd be rocking out in front of stadium crowds live on television. He'd bathe in the tears of his betrayers, each tear wiped dry by a crisp, clean $100 bill. And so the guitarist worked as if possessed by a musical demon. He spent months recruiting the best musicians he could find, far better musicians than his previous bandmates. He wrote dozens of songs and practiced religiously. His seething anger fueled his ambition. Revenge became his muse. Within a couple years, his new band had signed a record deal of their own, and a year after that, their first record would go gold. The guitarist's name was Dave Mustaine, and the new band he formed was the legendary heavy metal band Megadeth. Megadeth would go on to sell over 25 million albums and tour the world many times over. Today, Mustaine is considered one of the most brilliant and influential musicians in the history of heavy metal music. Unfortunately, the band he was kicked out of was Metallica, which has sold over 180 million albums worldwide. Metallica is considered by many to be one of the greatest rock bands of all time. And because of this, in a rare intimate interview in 2003, a tearful Mustaine admitted that he couldn't help but still consider himself a failure. Despite all that he had accomplished, in his mind he would always be the guy who got kicked out of Metallica. We're apes. We think we're all sophisticated with our toaster ovens and designer footwear, but we're just a bunch of finely ornamented apes. And because we are apes, we instinctually measure ourselves against others and vie for status. The question is not whether we evaluate ourselves against others. Rather, the question is, by what standard do we measure ourselves? Dave Mustaine, whether he realized it or not, chose to measure himself by whether he was more successful and popular than Metallica. The experience of getting thrown out of his former band was so painful for him that he adopted success relative to Metallica as the metric by which to measure himself and his music career. Despite taking a horrible event in his life and making something positive out of it, as Mustaine did with Megadeth, his choice to hold on to Metallica's success as his life-defining metric continued to hurt him decades later. Despite all the money and the fans and the accolades, he still considered himself a failure. Now, you and I may look at Dave Mustaine's situation and laugh. Here's this guy with millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of adoring fans, a career doing the thing he loves best, and still he's getting all weepy-eyed that his rock star buddies from 20 years ago are way more famous than he is. This is because you and I have different values than Mustaine does, and we measure ourselves by different metrics. Our metrics are probably more like, "I don't want to work a job for a boss I hate," or,
I'd like to earn enough money to send my kid to a good school. Or, I'd be happy not to wake up in a drainage ditch. And by these metrics, Mustaine is wildly, unimaginably successful. But by his metric, be more popular and successful than